Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and once again I'm recovering from laryngitis, so my voice doesn't sound like myself at all. In fact, I feel like I sound like Froggy and our gang. I remember an episode when I was a kid watching The Little Rascals, and there's that kid Froggy that had that horrible voice that sounds a little bit like I sound right now. And he said, I remember at the end of one of the episodes, he made some kind of a comment, and somebody who didn't know him said, "Wow, do you always sound that way?" And he said, "No, sir, only when I talk." And so I always sound this way when I talk, and I have laryngitis, and that was true a little less so yesterday, actually. I'm somewhat recovering, but it's up and down. I really don't know if it's going to be the case that we can keep having live shows all week, since I can't predict the course of this particular condition. But we're going to try it again. We have a half hour together today. Don't worry about my throat. It doesn't hurt. It's just my voice that's so weird. But we're going to go through the regular procedure, take your calls if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, and we'll talk to you about those in the coming half hour. The number to call is 800-227-5278. That's 800-227-5278. Our first caller today is Sandy, and he's calling from San Jose. Sandy, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I just pray that the Lord would give you your voice back, and we just pray that His mercy would be with you and heal you. Steve, my question is,
thank you,
is about church. My question is about church governance. You know, specifically, it's when I say church governance, it's corporate. 501(c), if you will. You're one of those. You're a 501(c). Is that the right word? And so you have to have a board of directors and things like that in order to be sort of legal by the state. Calvary Chapel has to have that too. And they have what's called the Moses Principle of Governance, although they have a board of directors and all that. Are you familiar with the Calvary Chapel? They call it the Moses Principle of Leadership.
Yes, pretty much.
I guess my question on that is, it seems dangerous, and I just wanted to get your opinions. When there's one person that calls all the shots, there's other churches I've been to where the board of directors and the pastor of the conference are the board of directors, and it looks like within Calvary's Chapel denomination, the senior pastor is it, and he's the Lord's anointed. And I'm just wondering, I've seen abuse from Calvary Chapel. I'm not a Calvary Chapel fan, and I'm wondering if this principle that Chuck laid down years ago is really not a healthy one. I want to get your opinions on it. Maybe I'm just bitter at the denomination, that, of course, they say they're not a denomination, but I'm not a real happy Calvary Chapel person. So give me your thoughts. I appreciate your perspective, and feel free to push back on me if I'm not acting in Christian accord.
Well, Sandy, of course, you've probably had experience with only one Calvary Chapel primarily because, I mean, they're not all the same. They do all have the same Moses principle. That's true. And obviously, when you have a one-man leader of a church, the quality of that experience is going to depend on the quality of that particular man. If you have multiple leaders, like an eldership, like the biblical model, even so, the quality of that leadership is going to depend on the quality of the men in the eldership. So if you have one experience in a particular denomination, whether it's a Calvary Chapel or any other, and it's a bad experience, it's important not to write off the whole movement and to make sure that what you experienced is not necessarily characteristic of all the groups. Now, I will say, I have a Calvary Chapel background myself, as you know, and I've had good experiences with Calvary Chapel, and I've had experiences that weren't as good. And I've been an elder in a Calvary Chapel for several years at one time, a long time ago, and my experiences were good there, but I've had a few experiences that weren't. And that's been true of most of the denominations that I've had any contact with. I do disagree philosophically with the Moses model of leadership. And basically what we're talking about is, instead of having a group of elders who have the final say in things in the church, you have a pastor who's like Moses in the congregation. He's like the prophet of God. And, you know, pretty much things do have to go his way in the end, because that's the way things are set up. That's the way the bylaws are set up. Now, Calvary Chapel is not the only group that has that kind of a model, but they do. But here's the thing. This got set up when Chuck Smith was the only pastor of an only Calvary Chapel. Costa Mesa was the only Calvary Chapel for many years. And Chuck Smith, I believe, you know, was the man, the anointed one that God raised up to build that movement. And I don't think he abused that. I think that although he had all the power in the leadership, I don't think he abused that. I think he was a humble man and a loving man, and I think he maintained that power for the safety of the movement, because he had such radical ideas, different from most churches, in that he was trying to get away from the abuses of many churches. And I think he wanted to make sure that the vision he felt God had given him is implemented, so he set it up the way he did, so that he made the decisions. But he was not, as I remember Chuck, he was not really a bossy guy or a power-hungry guy. I think he saw his authority as keeping the church safe from influences that he didn't think were good in the church. Of course, almost every pastor would say that. But in the case of Chuck, I agreed with most of his radical ideas, and so I certainly never had any reason to object to Chuck being, you know, the big leader there at Calvary Costa Mesa when I was there. Now, when the Calvary became a movement, obviously it got spotty. They've got thousands of churches all over the country, and not all of them have good pastors. Some of them do. Some of them have wonderful pastors, and some don't. And so you're going to see that this model where one man has all the leadership is going to work okay when you've got a good leader, and it'd be terrible when you've got a dictatorial bad leader. And so I don't think the Bible actually supports that model of church governance. There are three models of church governance besides that one, which are commonly practiced. You've got the Episcopal, which has a bishop overseeing a bunch of churches. Maybe that's the closest thing you've got to Calvary Chapel style. You've got the Presbyterian form, which has a local eldership governing the church. And then you have the congregational style, which is more of a democratic style. The congregation has the power to vote in pastors and vote them out and things like that, about things. I think the Presbyterian style is the most scriptural, and that is where there's a body of elders in the church who make the decisions for the church. But just because one style is modeled in Scripture and the others are not, does not mean that the others can't work. The main thing about church governments is that Jesus has to be the head.
Right.
And any church
right.
that's set up in such a way, any church that's set up in such a way that Jesus' headship is honored and not interfered with is probably okay. Even if it doesn't have the style of governance that you find taught in the Bible. In other words, I think a church that has a congregational style of government, or one that has Presbyterian style, or one that has Episcopal style, I think any of them can be good churches if the leaders are following the leading of Jesus Christ, and therefore Jesus remains the head of that congregation. But whenever you have, of course, bad leaders, it doesn't matter what style of leadership or what model of leadership you have. Bad leaders that interfere with Christ's headship of the church are a bad thing. So it's not a thing that we can just lay to the door of one denomination. It has more to do with the individual people. It has to do with the individual people in leadership, not so much the governance pattern.
Well, so maybe one last question, Steve. This is something I'm struggling with right now. You had younger kids, you know, in their teens, and they asked you if they could go away to a Calvary Chapel camp over the summer. Knowing what everything you know about Calvary Chapel today and the past, would you let your kids go?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Yes, I would. I went to Calvary Chapel camps when I was a teenager, and I thought they were great. I mean, I thought, you know, it's just a focus on Bible teaching and worship and things like that. I mean, at any kind of church camp, you can find, again, bad kids or bad leaders. I'm not saying there's never been any abuse at any, you know, church camp. I know there probably have been, but I can't think of any reason to avoid a Calvary Chapel camp as opposed to any other church camp. If anything, I think it'd be great for 99% of the people who go.
Okay. Well, I respect what you're saying, Steve. I appreciate all you do, and I appreciate your wisdom. And obviously, I've gone through some stuff that I've tried to deal with. And so thank you so much, and I do pray that your voice would get back to where it should be, where I'd like it to see, or if you'd like it to be. Okay, brother?
Someday, I hope it will. Thanks, Sandy.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye now. You know, you might think it's pretty inconvenient to have laryngitis when you do a talk radio show every day, but it's even more inconvenient when I have to go from this show to teach 3 hours of lectures. I'm at YWAM in Kona, and all week long I'm speaking 3 hours every morning. So it's not a real good week to have laryngitis, but doing radio shows and 3 hours of lectures a day, it's not the best situation for recovery from laryngitis. It kind of slows down the recovery process, I think. Let's talk to Richard from Thousand Oaks. Hi, Richard. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Steve. Hope you recover fast. The question
Thanks.
About a passage in Mark chapter 7, verses about 26, 27, about the Phoenician woman whose daughter has a demon, and she asks Christ to take the demon out of her daughter, and he says, first, that is, before I do that, let the children eat all they want, or it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. Now, I don't understand that. She must have understood it, because her response back to the Lord was one that he accepted, and he went ahead and took the demon out. Could you explain that response of Christ in relation to what she was asking? And I'll get off the cell phone here and listen on the radio. Appreciate your answer. Thank you very much.
Okay, Richard. He says, at the dinner table, first let the children be fed, and then the dogs get fed later. They're not the first priority. In a family, it's the first priority to feed the children and then feed the pet. And so he's simply stating a principle of priority there. The kids come first. Now, she was a Gentile. And in Jesus' analogy, the kids were the Jews. The Jews were God's people, God's family. The Gentiles were, unclean, like a dog was unclean. And so he was basically saying, I'm here just at this point to minister to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He was not saying that he would never minister to Gentiles, but his first priority was to reach Jews. The first priority is the children at the table, not the dogs under the table. Now, she was great about that. I mean, some people would be insulted. What, you calling me a dog? And kind of he was. I mean, but not... not meaning it in a totally insulting way. The Gentiles knew that the Jews regarded Gentiles not as family members. That's just the prejudice that was well known between Jews and Gentiles. But she accepted that. But she said, but even the dogs get the scraps that fall from the children's table. And Jesus was impressed by her answer and said, oh, woman, great is your faith. Be it unto you, as you've said, your daughter's helped, And what she was saying is, there's enough food to go around. And after all, the kids are dropping some of the food on the floor. Can the dogs eat that? Of course they can eat that. You don't object to the dogs getting some of the scraps if they're falling from the table at the children's meal time. The kids aren't going to eat the food that fell on the floor, so the dogs get that. And she's saying one of two things. In either case, Jesus was very pleased with her answer, but she is either saying, there's so much food to go around that there's plenty for the kids and for the dogs. So much so that, scraps for the dogs fall off the table and the kids don't lack for food anyway. There's enough to go around. Or she was saying, and this is not clear, she could have been saying, the kids don't like the food and they're throwing it on the floor. Can't the dogs have the food that the children reject? Even if she said that, it would make good sense because she would be perceiving that the Jewish people were not being as receptive to Christ and what he was trying to feed them, as it were, as they should be. And they may be like children throwing their food on the floor. And she was a Gentile, a dog, she would appreciate what they were not appreciating. And so she either was saying there's enough food to go around, or she's even saying the Jews are rejecting what you're doing, but I won't. I'm not too proud to eat the scraps. And Jesus was very impressed with her humility and more even with her faith, that she believed that God would take care of Gentiles as well as Jews, even though God in history had not done much of that. not in the same way as he was going to through Christ. So she was just expressing faith that even though she was not a Jew, even though she was in the picture, in the story, a dog, that the master of the house cares for the dogs too, and would not deprive them the scraps that the children aren't eating or wouldn't eat. So that's what I think he's saying. I'm not sure if there's further you wanted to go with that, but and since you're not on the line, we can't, you know, go back and forth much about that. But that's what I understand him to be saying. But when he says, first, let the children be fed, he's not saying, before I help you, I'm going to feed all the children. He's just stating a principle. It should be first priority to feed the children, and afterwards the family dog. And he's sort of stating that as a principle. But then she comes back with a great answer, and so he says, oh, because of your faith, I'm going to certainly make an exception for you. As he did also with the centurion who had a sick servant. The centurion was a Gentile also and came and requested help from Jesus, and he had more faith, Jesus said, than the Israelites had. So these two examples are examples of, you know, where Jesus was really coming to the Jews first and not to the Gentiles, but the Gentiles who had exceptional faith often got what they wanted from Jesus, and sometimes put the Jews to shame because the Jews didn't have the same faith in him that these Gentiles did, as Jesus commented. Let's talk to Paul from Tijuana, Mexico. Paul, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Well, you can kind of hear.
Yeah, I heard you're having trouble with your voice. Well, the Lord kind of heal you. I was wondering, how did a snake that God created as a beast of the field become Satan that deceived the whole world? You know, I don't believe Lucifer was Satan. I don't believe Ezekiel 28 is talking about Satan either. What do you say?
Well, the snake, it specifically says in Genesis that the serpent was the most subtle of all the creatures that God had made. So we're talking about an actual serpent, and it's a creature that God made. However, we know that the voice of the serpent that communicated with Eve was not the serpent's natural voice, because serpents don't talk. It was Satan. And so we find in the book of Revelation that Satan is called that ancient serpent, the devil. And so, you know, the Bible acknowledges that the serpent was Satan, although it doesn't tell us so in Genesis. In Genesis, it's just always the serpent we're hearing from. But I think we have to understand that the serpent was possessed by Satan. And, you know, for animals to be possessed by demons is not unheard of. I mean, in the Gospels, we read of a herd of swine being possessed by demons. So both humans and animals can be demon-possessed. I believe that Satan possessed the serpent, very possibly because it was so beautiful and wise. And by the way, serpents seem loathsome to people many times now today, but they are, if you didn't have a sort of that creepy feeling that comes, I think, as a result of the fall, serpents can be very beautiful. I mean, they're very beautiful animals. If we didn't know that they bite, or if we didn't know their history, or if there wasn't this animosity between us and serpents that the Genesis 3 seems to add, I think we'd think they're very, very beautiful creatures. I think Satan chose one of them to be the mouthpiece for him. He could have used something else. Something spoke through a donkey. I guess it was God spoke through a donkey, or the donkey itself was given the power to express its own thoughts in a later story in the Bible. And these kind of stories really bother skeptics. They even bother Christians sometimes. They don't bother me. I mean, I don't see any problem with it. I've heard of demon-possessed people speaking with several voices at the same time, and even in different languages at the same time, because they had multiple demons in them. And it's clear that it's not entirely, you know, limited to the vocal apparatus of the person. The devil can apparently speak bypassing the vocal apparatus if you've got several voices speaking at the same time out of one person. And that, you know, I had a talk with, actually, Hank Hanegraaff one day over dinner about this serpent thing, and he and I differ. He believes the story of the serpent is more of a parable kind of a thing. He doesn't believe it's literally a serpent talking. And the reason we disagreed, he said, is because a serpent doesn't even have the, you know, the vocal apparatus for speaking to do that. And my answer was, I don't know that demons need to use the vocal cords and the vocal apparatus to speak. Especially, as I say, when a demon-possessed person with several demons can sometimes speak several voices at the same time, are they really depending on the person's vocal cords, or is there some bypass going on there? I don't know. But when the Bible says that the serpent spoke, and it's clear that what the serpent spoke was it was Satan's message, that the devil was speaking through the serpent. Unless, of course, we don't take the story literally. I do. I think it's a literally true story, but some Christians might take it as as sort of a illustrative parable or something. But I don't see a good reason to do that.
But Jesus spoke to the serpent. He cursed the serpent. He didn't say anything but Satan. And how would Satan get entrance into an animal in the Garden of Eden?
Satan was there. Satan is a spirit. Satan is a spirit, and he was obviously allowed to enter the serpent. The serpent was cursed. You're right. It went on its belly. And I don't think the serpent knows it's suffering for that. I don't think serpents are smart enough to know that they're on their belly and that that's a disadvantage. I think that it's not that the serpents suffer for what their ancestor did. I think it's rather that God has put sort of the mark of that story on the whole group of snakes, so that when we see a snake, we remember that it was, that Satan spoke through one of them, and it's been cursed by going on its belly now. But I mean, there's many things that are not explained. I'm giving my hunches. I'm giving my theories off the top of my head. I mean, because I don't really know the answers. The Bible doesn't answer those things.
Right. But, see, why didn't Jesus speak to Satan? And Jesus himself called him the serpent of old. He didn't, so it's still...
Okay, well, in my opinion, he did speak to Satan. I think he spoke to Satan. I think that Satan was, at that time, identified with his host, the serpent. And when God said to the serpent that the seed of the woman and your seed will be... have hostility toward each other, and the seed of the woman will crush your head, and you will bruise his heel. I believe that God was saying to the serpent that Satan would have his head crushed by Christ. I believe it's kind of a mysterious statement, but I believe that's what he was saying. We're almost out of time, but Helen from Carson, California. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My question is, are there any prophets left? And if so, if not, who was the last prophet? And I'll hang up and listen for your answer. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, the gift of prophecy, I believe, still exists, because I believe that all the gifts of the Spirit still exist. But when we talk about a prophet, we're not simply talking about somebody who has a gift of prophecy. We're talking about somebody who holds an office of prophet. As Paul said, there are apostles, and there are prophets, and there are evangelists, and pastors, and teachers. Now, an evangelist is somebody who preaches the gospel. But any individual might share the gospel with somebody else, and that doesn't make them hold the office of an evangelist. Anyone might teach their children or their neighbor certain spiritual truths, but that doesn't make them hold the office of a teacher. And certainly there are people who, plant churches and do the things that apostles did, but that doesn't mean they hold the office of an apostle. Similarly, the gift of prophecy might operate through somebody without them necessarily holding the office of a prophet. We're talking about the office of a prophet or apostle or teacher or evangelist. We're really talking about somebody, at least in the first century, who is recognized as set aside by God to do that all the time, to prophesy faithfully, to prophesy regularly all the time, so that the church would come to trust anything this person said in the name of the Lord, because they were a prophet. Agabus, in the book of Acts, is called a prophet. Silas is referred to as a prophet in the book of Acts. But there's not very many people who are. But even though there's not very many people who are referred to by name as prophets, we do know that there were prophets. Paul said to the Corinthian church, let the prophets speak two or three, and let the others judge. So there would be two or three, at least, if not more, prophets that could speak in the church of Corinth. And so I believe that there have been many prophets, but most of them, we don't know their names. If they don't exist anymore, we don't know which would be the last of them. And I don't say they don't exist. What I would say is the ability to prophesy is a gift that God still operates in the church, but it may not be through persons who hold offices of prophet. Or it might be. I don't know. We are never told that the office of the prophet was going to vanish, or that the office of apostle is going to vanish. There's no suggestion in the Bible that those offices would disappear. On the other hand, we are told in Ephesians 2 that those two offices of apostle and prophet were the foundation. The church was built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets. And the church, of course, began to be built in the first century, and the apostles and prophets in the first century laid that foundation of the church. Since that time, evangelists and pastors and teachers and so forth have built on that foundation. I don't know if we still have apostles and prophets today, because I know lots of people who claim to be one, but they don't impress me by their actual credentials. There may be some out there, but I have not been able to ascertain that from personal experience. And the Bible does not tell us whether we're going to have apostles and prophets, you know, until the end of the age. Maybe we do. If so, I can't point any out to you. I wish I could. We're out of time, however, today for our broadcast, I'm sorry to say. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or our website is a good place to do that. That's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us.